Welcome to Mill Liberty, the voice of liberty for a new generation.
All right, Joe Walsh,
Matt Kibbe,
John Stossel, welcome to Mill Liberty.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
Hey, Caleb, I mean this. It's great to be with you. Thank you for the invite.
This week, we are going to be going over the myths and realities that surround monopolies. Teddy Roosevelt hated small government. The gateway into space will help alleviate a lot of this problem.
It was a fateful error we took 100 years ago with this kind of monopolization of banking and centralization of money and credit.
Automation, streamlined productivity, and cost effectiveness.
There's two big government parties, and one of them is red and one of them is blue.
We are creating a community of liberty lovers. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the ride. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to this week's edition of the Mill Liberty Podcast. I'm your host, Caleb Franz, and this is the voice of liberty for a new generation. I am thrilled to have you here this week. Do me a favor and please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and tell at least one or two or maybe even three of your friends to do the same. So that way we continue to grow as a podcast and as an organization. I hope you had a great Thanksgiving last week. Last Thursday was Thanksgiving. As you know, Thursdays are the days that we release our podcast episodes here. So we did not release one last week. So that way everyone sort of had the chance to have a break last week. And that's going to be, again, likely the case around the time of Christmas on this month, at the end of this month. But with that being said, we have a bunch of really, really great interviews throughout the month to take us out to the end of the year. One in particular, hopefully, will be a big bang to end the year on. So look out for more information on that. We'll hopefully have some more information on that soon if it all works out. But this week is going to be a very, very deep dive conversation. It's going to be a really important conversation. Over the past month in November, it was really politically focused. We had a lot of conversations with people who were either involved in politics in the LP or who just has a lot of insights in electoral politics. That was mostly our focus for that month since we were a year out for the 2020 election. And then, of course, back in October, we had our Horrors of Collectivism series. This week, we have an episode that I am really excited about because it dives into subject matters that just are so fascinating to me. And you'll hear it throughout the interview. I say that, you know, we can really go on for as long as possible if time allowed for us. But it is only about a 30-minute interview. My interview this week is with Ryan Carana. Now, Ryan is the executive director for the Institute for Advancing Prosperity. It's a Canadian think tank, and he is also a Young Voices advocate, which is how I got a hold of him and became acquainted with him. And we have a really great conversation on the future of technology and the future of innovation, automation, artificial intelligence. Really, we covered quite a bit of ground in this interview. So I want to talk with you real quick before we go into that. I want to talk with you real quick about some of my thoughts. A lot of people have a lot of fears anytime something new happens. As an instinct, people are very opposed to change. And that stems from a lot of natural instincts. You know, if a lot of things changed back before we had all this technology and great innovation and everything like that, that could lead to death for you or your tribe or, you know, whatever the case may have been several thousand years ago. Now, that's not the case. In fact, now it's beneficial to change. It's beneficial to adapt. And the people who adapt the fastest, you might be able to create a stable life if you don't change, but the people who adapt the fastest typically lead the most prosperous lives. And I think that's something that a lot of us here are forgetting. One, and two, a lot of people have agendas in America and across the world where it really relies on them to remain fearful at all times. It relies on people to be antithetical to change. You know, there are people like Josh Hawley who every new technology or every new advancement in technological innovation just scares the ever-loving hell out of him. And every time he's on the Senate floor or he's in some sort of a committee, there's a very, very good chance that this is something that he's talking about. And as libertarians, we can't be playing defense on this issue, okay? If anything, libertarians are the ones who are the most adaptable. They're the most apt to just go with the flow, to ride along a progress train. We're the ones who welcome new innovations because that's part of the market system. A lot of conservatives, and especially a lot of liberals, on both sides have this really skewed view of what markets are supposed to be. They have this really skewed view of what capitalism is supposed to be, if they believe in capitalism at all. And that is that it's supposed to create some sort of stability, or it's supposed to create some sort of prosperity that will just always be the same. And that's not it. Capitalism is fundamentally at its core about change and disruption and innovation, and all of those things should be welcomed with open arms. Now, that's not to say that there can't be some negative effects to it, but it has a net positive. It's not to say that people won't lose their jobs, but more jobs will be gained than jobs will be lost. It's not to say that governments can't use certain technologies in nefarious ways, but those technologies have much more of a net positive than a net negative. Those technologies have a much more greater chance of bringing about greater human interactions than they do human destruction. And the further along that we get down the road with technology and with advancements in innovation, the harder it becomes for governments to play catch up. That's the thing with the free market, is that it's always, sometimes in the worst case scenario, it's always a couple steps ahead. In the best case scenario, it's miles ahead. And government is always playing catch up. And whenever they finally get a hold of that latest new technology, there's something else that has captured the attention. And I think Bitcoin is, and cryptocurrencies, is a really good example of how government is just constantly blindsided by all these new technologies, and they always have to react. Eventually, it's going to get to the point, I believe, to where governments won't be able to really react at all unless they capitalize on the moment currently and try to use the new technology that's spurring up and the new innovation that's spurring up to dramatically halt any further innovation from occurring. Now, that's not to say that that's exactly going to happen, but it is something to be cautious about. But if there's anything to be cautious about, it's that. It's not necessarily the innovation itself. A lot of people are scared of artificial intelligence. A lot of people are scared of automation and what that's going to do to their jobs. A lot of people are scared of new technology in general. And if you're going to be fearful of anything, my message to you is this. Don't be fearful of the technology itself. That always leads to greater prosperity, greater living conditions across the world. Yes, there were a great adjustment periods during the Industrial Revolution. But I don't think any sane person would look at the Industrial Revolution today and say, you know what, I wish that didn't happen. I wish we were back in the agricultural age where we were all just a bunch of farmers just barely getting by, and the vast majority of us were, in fact, impoverished. That's not the case today. The American middle class is a 20th, 21st century advent. That's not something that really happened before that, because of advancements of technology and because of advancements of innovation. All of these things work together to bring about greater human conditions. If we stop that, that's only going to detriment us. It's not going to detriment the companies that people think it will, and that technology is not going to detriment the people. Only a stifle in innovation will do that. So that's something that I really want you to keep in mind when we're having these conversations. And we can have really deep conversations about these and really honest conversations about these, because that's a wide open ballpark. I think a lot of people really don't know what to think about a lot of new innovations that are spurring up all the time. So it allows for a truly genuine and honest conversation to be had if you remove the fear component. And that is vitally, vitally important. So we're going to have that exact kind of conversation here in this interview. Please enjoy my interview with Ryan Khurana, the executive director of the Institute for Advancing Prosperity and a Young Voices advocate on the future of technology. Okay, Ryan, welcome to the Maliberty podcast. I am absolutely thrilled to have you on. Welcome aboard.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So for those who don't know about you or about the work that you do, can you give us maybe a brief little overview of sort of everything and your interests that that you have specifically in sort of the field of tech and all the, I guess, up-and-coming issues that we face?
Yeah, sure. So I kind of got started in my interest here. My background's in philosophy and economics, and I was always quite interested in policy. But around 2015, I started seeing a lot of really cool advances in artificial intelligence that kind of blew me away. They were unexpected and showed that the technology had a lot of potential at solving problems that were too complicated for people to solve historically. And so I started looking into that field more and assessing its impact. And I got really interested in the topic of automation. And so I spent, that's probably my main topic that I cover. And I look at the impact of automation more generally and assess what kind of jobs are susceptible and whether the panic is as big as people say it is. And I find that field really interesting because there's so many conflicts in understanding what automation is and what its impact is, and there's a lot of anxiety about it. So it's definitely such a relevant hot button topic, and I'm so happy to have contributed to that conversation over the past several years.
Yeah, I feel like most people, when you say the word automation or artificial intelligence or anything like that, the first thing that sort of comes to mind are like images of the Terminator coming into, you know, in the world, and quite in most cases, that's not what that is.
No, in almost no case would that be what it is. The idea, like, this is actually one of the an issue more with nomenclature than anything else, because historically, when we think of AI, you know, in movies, it's been the HAL 9000s, it's been the Terminators. But what we talk about when we talk about artificial intelligence today, it's an approach called machine learning. And this approach has been out for a really long time, but only recently, thanks to advances brought by the internet and increases in computing power, which is much cheaper today than it was decades earlier. This approach, which just uses statistics and tons of data to find hidden relationships that human beings would not see and derive insight that's in the structure of the data that we wouldn't understand, it's becoming popular. And in many ways, the use of the term AI is more of a marketing buzz than anything else, in my opinion.
Right, right.
Is there a situation in which you see that that possibly could end up, I guess, in the worst case scenario, or do you think that all of that is just, irrelevant?
At this point in time, it's certainly irrelevant, and even the advances we're getting in machine learning aren't building us towards a Terminator-type agent, or even, to take away the malevolence, even a benevolent agent. That's not something that this is building towards. But there is a field of research which some organizations like DeepMind, which is owned by Google, and OpenAI, which is run by Sam Altman, who founded Y Combinator, one of the most successful venture capital firms, who are focused on a specific type approach to AI called artificial general intelligence. And they want to do more than, solve specific problems with AIs, but they want to build a reasoning agent that can solve any problem that it's given. And that's nowhere near the capacity we have today. Right now, the algorithms we have are what is called brittle. They're trained to solve a very specific problem, and they perform at superhuman capacities on that very specific problem. But if any kind of information or objective is given beyond what they were designed for, they make absurd claims or end up with absurd results that just are obviously nonsensical to a person. And so they're very, very task specific at this point in time.
Yeah. So there, in the field of tech, there's obviously a lot of influential people. There are people like your Elon Musks who are just doing, batshit crazy things every other day. And then there are people like Peter Thiel who have a few more reservations with artificial intelligence and things like that. And I think those two, and correct me if I'm wrong, but those two individuals, I think, pretty well encompass the two fields of thought when it comes to this issue. Would you agree with that?
Well, I would say both have reservations, but different types of reservations. Like Musk is quite famously skeptical of the positive impact AI will have. He's one that does trumpet up the kind of concerns about a Terminator-style intelligence coming up. But I guess I would say he's more optimistic about technological innovation in general.
Right.
Whereas Peter Thiel doesn't talk about these doomsday scenarios as much, but is a little more pessimistic on the side where he doesn't believe we're having as much innovation today as we've historically had, and that the advances in AI, while impressive, are nowhere near the level that people make them out to be.
And I think that's interesting because, Elon Musk is the one who's literally trying to connect the human brain with with robotics or artificial intelligence. And that's an interesting claim to come from him because, of course, if he has those fears, then those are interesting steps to be taken. Do you think that any of the people in Silicon Valley should be individuals to be worried about? And perhaps maybe it's not necessarily the artificial intelligence itself, but maybe the people behind it that could have maybe some more nefarious purposes, or maybe even take Silicon Valley out of the equation and maybe some foreign actors or something like that. Do you see that those are possibly a problem, or do you think that that's also something that's not as likely?
I certainly think there is a concern with excessive power given to any individual or group in technology. I wouldn't say go so far as to say, specific individuals or like name names, because it's less an issue of a malicious person having access to this versus a benevolent person, but more technological progress opens up the opportunity for lots of inequalities, especially inequalities in control. And we see, to give an example of this, where you have lots of platform apps today, like the Ubers of the world, and there's so many that want to develop a company that Uberizes a certain field. And a lot of these firms do not really have any semblance of turning a profit. Their entire business plan is oriented to making as much venture capital money as possible. And that venture capital money comes when they show that they're asset light, where they don't own a lot. And so they go out of their way to reduce the number of employees they have, even if people are doing the same amount of work that an employee would do. And just to not have those people on the books helps these people look more lean and get more funding. And that seems to be, to me, like an example of that kind of inequality where your specific objective as a firm is to, you know, circumvent labor laws and to reduce the bargaining power of your employees, even if they're doing the same amount of work. And in many ways, the concern that comes from that is just who gets control over the opportunities afforded, where if things are getting more productive and if technologies are enabling so many things to happen, but only a small number of people have control over it, you're not leading to the widespread benefit that would be ideal from technological innovation, or that we should demand from technological innovation.
So one of the things that I constantly hear about this issue in particular, and this is really the case every time something new comes out, is that, you know, it's different this time. Either technology is advancing too quickly, or there's just not enough time for people to adjust, or, you know, pick the argument, really. But there's always some sort of argument being made against technological advancements, or at least in the without some sort of regulation to keep it at bay. Do you think that those claims hold any sort of water? And second of all, do you think that there are any sort of regulations that you would sort of get behind, I suppose, or can see as a valid reason to put regulation on a certain form of technology or a certain business that are doing things that have otherwise been sort of unforeseen?
I guess my issue would be a little bit with that framing. It's less, I disagree with the notion that, you know, things are different this time, or it's getting so fast that we need to slow it down. That I don't agree with, but I also somewhat disagree with this, slightly with this notion of, you know, permissionless innovation, that regulation is what gets in the way of new technologies. The kind of markets that create innovation are bounded by the rules of the game, the regulations that are in place, and they incentivize certain things and disincentivize others. And they play a key role in building the environment that allows technology to be built, and allow it to be built in a way that leads to prosperity for many people rather than just a few. So I'm personally a big fan of the economist Glenn Weil, who's at Microsoft Research and Princeton. And he wrote a book not too long ago called Radical Markets. And it's from a field called mechanism design in economics, which would argue, you know, your markets are really efficient at accomplishing their objectives. But objectives don't exist in the wild. They're framed by the kind of initial conditions that are set. And I think setting those conditions is an important task for public policy, to guide new innovations towards the right end. And you don't regulate it specifically. I'm not someone who's advocating, you know, let's say AI is dangerous, so it puts some specific regulations on that technology. But a great example of regulations that would help is a good privacy framework. Now, we have the dominant privacy framework in the world today is the European Union's General Data Protection Regulation. And that's one of those very heavy-handed, very specific regulatory frameworks that has all these means-based conditions for companies to follow, which are quite costly and which may be, in my opinion, counterproductive. But if you have a good privacy framework that makes it clear, here's what you can and cannot do, here's what we want from privacy and our objectives as a society, you create clarity of conditions in which everyone, every actor in the market is able to understand what they're allowed to do, what they're not allowed to do, and has a level playing field in which to innovate. And that helps a lot of people, because there's, especially with the privacy game, there is so much anxiety about what you're allowed to do with people's data that without a clear framework, you're probably going to be a little too cautious, or you're probably going to get a huge PR scandal when you go too far.
Mm-hmm. So let's take, I think privacy is a really good example that you brought up there, but let's take, you know, AI and stuff like that, because I feel like that's still a little bit distant for a lot of people. It's still a little bit, you know, abstract, but something that's very, very real and something we encounter every day is, like, for example, social media. And that's in the news constantly, and the discussion on whether or not, or just big tech companies like Google or, you know, things like that. And basically there's a lot of discussions on, you know, have these companies become monopolies, and do there need to be any sort of regulatory guidelines with regard to how social media companies interact? And I think that's a really important discussion, because admittedly, it is a very different field. It's not really anything like what we've experienced before. But also at the same time, that's no less the case than like what radio was 100 years ago or more, whenever it first really became popular. And same thing with television and things like that. So it's very different, but it's also a lot of the same. A lot of the discussions that we're having is a lot of the same. Do you see that there could be any case to be made in those categories? I know you sort of indicated privacy would be possibly one, but any sort of regulation or government action that can be taken in those categories, or do you think that it's better left alone for the consumer to sort of pick and choose, sort of like the way they chose Facebook over MySpace as kind of an example there? Do you think that's better to be left to the consumer?
Well, I guess it also there it depends on what we mean by regulation. Like if it's saying, you know, one of the big debates on what to do with regulation with social media is an issue of content moderation. People on both sides are quite concerned. Oh, they're spreading fake news. Oh, violent and hateful content spreads. Hate speech spreads. They should be regulated. Some people are concerned about the inverse, saying that, oh, these companies don't allow certain types of content, therefore that's a violation of free speech. And so they want to put regulations on what is allowed to be shown on these platforms. That kind of specific regulation I have some concerns with, because content moderation is an extremely complicated topic. And we were talking about AI a little bit earlier. Like, it's one of those fields where most investment in AI is going, because it is so complicated to moderate content effectively that companies like Facebook are placing big bets on using new technologies to identify what's allowed and what isn't. But while that's the hotbed playing field, I don't know if there's a kind of regulatory approach to doing that specifically, to telling you what you can and cannot put on the sites that would be effective, because it's very hard to anticipate what would be posted. It's very hard to anticipate, like, norms change quite quickly. And so such a regulation would get outdated quite quickly, or be almost impossible to implement if it had a really general set of principles about what is and isn't allowed. However, at the same point in time, there are things we can do to improve the social media space. And I mentioned Glenn Weil's work earlier, and one of the big topics of discussion that he brings up and that a lot of people have engaged with is about the value of data that goes on these social media sites. Because, so take for example, Facebook. Facebook has over 2 billion users in the world, and it creates this community where the value of Facebook is the value of all other people in your social network. And it's very hard for you to derive value as an individual. No one wants to use Facebook without other people to interact with, or with other content that other people produce on that site. And so when that kind of beautiful mesh of all these people come, Facebook benefits that it has their interaction data, and it uses that interaction data to create marketing campaigns, and it's an ad-funded company. Now, all of that value that they're creating is because of this symbiotic relationship between the user and the company. That data that they collect wouldn't exist if you weren't on Facebook. It only exists because of the network they've created. But at the same point in time, Facebook wouldn't have gotten any of the money if you hadn't given them the interactions that allowed that data. So there is a mutual creator relationship here. It's not just a simple producer is Facebook and consumer is the user. And that leads to discussion about, wait, where is the value coming? And there's a standard line to debate, obviously, like Facebook is giving you the service for free, and so that's your compensation for what you contribute to it. But the value they create is quite huge, and so I think it's a pretty interesting discussion to have, saying that should you be paid for the kinds of data you can you produce on social media platforms, because the value is only created because of all these interactions that you have, and it would create this equality and bargaining, and it would enable people to interact with these social media platforms in new and creative ways, and it might be a spur to innovation, and that's my opinion, which is, you know, if you paid people for their data because they've contributed a bit to the creation of this entire platform, it would probably incentivize new and creative ways to use these platforms, and that would spur more and more innovation.
Yeah, that's a really interesting example that I hadn't considered before. Do you think that Facebook and Google are types of monopolies, modern day monopolies, or do you think that people who are saying that are typically maybe don't really understand the definition of the word?
Yeah, so a lot of the people who claim they are monopolies are using what I would say is a somewhat unconventional definition of monopoly. Unconventional in the sense that it's a more classical definition than today. They're certainly not monopolies in the sense that there's no competition to them. There's clearly inferior alternatives that exist, or very niche alternatives. If you're not going to use Google, it's because there's something specific you want that Google does not offer that most people don't care about, and so they'll use Google and you'll use DuckDuckGo.
Yep.
And so they're not monopolies in those in that sense of the world. They're not even monopolies in the conventional legal sense of causing harms to consumer welfare. You would see the investments in innovation these companies bring. Now, you can question whether their innovations are really that amazing, but they're clearly investing in enough R&D and trying to improve their service consistently enough that they're not doing the coasting effect that we'd expect of a typical monopoly that says, you know, I'm completely insulated from competition and therefore I don't need to care as much about improving the consumer experience. They're not acting like that either. So in the definitions of the term that are quite typically used, they're not monopolies by any means. However, there is a more classical definition of monopoly that I see used by some of the advocates. This is more common by people at an organization called the Open Markets Institute, which is that, you know, a monopoly is like a powerful entity is less about the harms it causes to consumers or its purely its market power, but its ability to use that market power to, I guess, rival the state's power. And that's, you know, if it's so big that it can exert political influence, that's a threat to democracy, and that we should consider a monopoly and we should take action against. And that's the definition that some of the more aggressive anti-big tech people would use. And so I guess the jury's out on whether that is the case. Obviously, people are somewhat concerned about the political influence that large tech companies can have. But then when we're talking about whether they're monopolies or not, it's really important to consider, what do you consider the harms of a monopoly? And that economic conversation about what they are is radically different than a conversation about their potential political influence. And the way you would discuss it is different. But on the economic level, I don't think there's any evidence that they're monopolies.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good way to put it, that, you know, certainly we can have those conversations about what kind of an influence they have, you know, whether or not they are doing harmful things or beneficial things to society, and all sorts of other sorts of conversations. But I think that really stems from, what are you saying that they are? You know, what definitions are you using? Because a lot of times people will use, they'll throw terms around willy-nilly, and monopoly is an example of that, where they're really just talking about they're a really large and powerful business or corporation, not necessarily a monopoly, but they know that using the term monopoly stirs up certain types of fears, or it stirs up certain types of emotions that you wouldn't typically get by just saying, well, they're a business, or well, mm-hmm. they're a corporation. Monopoly typically means something very specifically, and using that term, it helps sort of get more people behind their cause, whether or not their cause is, you know, breaking it up or implementing certain sorts of regulations. It's a lot easier if they're painted in a darker picture than just being a business.
Yeah, I know, for sure. And to me, you mentioned the breaking up thing, and this is one of the odd things about the antitrust crusade against big tech companies. Like, I don't really understand what would occur if you break a company like Google.
Right. Yeah.
Because there's basically one of the terms that a lot of the people who like to argue that they are monopolies like to use is something called network effects. And that's certainly an effect that does dominate internet companies. And a network effect is based on similar to what I was describing earlier, that the value of Facebook is your network. And a network effect essentially says where as the value increases for all other people on the site, there will be a tipping point in which everyone would want to use one site rather than anything else because everyone else is on it.
Right.
This is certainly the case in the short run, where it's like you do not have a constant split across different social media platforms at any one given moment in time. But these network effects are really unstable. Like, people will move en masse to something else. And so there are other things that allow keep people staying in the same place. And a few of those are just, you know, the economies of scale of the sites. These sites are really big. They do lots of different things. And that's the economies of scope part, which is they have these teams that the smartest people they hire from all these different disciplines working on tons of different projects who are cross-pollinating each other. And, you know, having a bunch of smart people in a room leads them to accomplish a lot more as if a bunch of smart people were in separate rooms, right? And so that's something that they do. And then finally, they have this learning by doing thing. The fact that they have that little bit of room where everyone likes their site originally, where they're doing lots of different things, where they have a lot of users and resources, allows them to figure out, hey, here's where our mistakes are, and get better and better. So it's not just this kind of, you know, the system is rigged and they can't be taken down. They have to work really hard to make sure that they continue to get the smartest people, to continue to understand that they're like, here are our mistakes and here's how we fix them. Because if they don't, that power that they have is extremely unstable. And beyond, you know, you gave the Facebook MySpace example. Like, the same thing kind of happened. There was a site before Reddit called Dig, and it changed its policies so that their user base didn't like it. Overnight, Reddit exploded because en masse, all their users left. And so even though you had this site where everyone was on, it was really unstable to have that equilibrium of everyone using it. But at any given point in time, yeah, everyone probably uses one or two different things.
Mm-hmm. So I'm a bit of a optimist when it comes to technological advancements. I think for the most part over human history that technology has greatly, obviously benefited humanity. And of course, there have always been a few setbacks. There's always a little bit of give and take, whether in the more mild sense you're talking about relearning some skills or learning new skills, rather. And then, you know, maybe in the greater sense, you have governments using technology for nefarious purposes, which is, I think, probably my greatest fear with any sort of technological advancement is how could it be used by the state in terrible ways. But that isn't at all a reason to stifle technological advancement. So one of the things that excites me is how, because obviously technology is something that I'm really interested in, but also so is, for example, space travel and things like that. And I see a lot of advancements in technology really pushing the envelope in that front as well. Is there a specific area that really excites you about what the possibilities might unlock with, say, the next new technological advancement, whether it be AI or you know, automation or whatever it may be?
I guess it depends, because one of the things that I've kind of felt looking at the pace of technological development the last several years is the longer I go, the more I kind of like think that it's not as impressive as I once thought it was. There's a mystique around not understanding what's going on, which makes small changes look like giant leaps. One of my concerns, though, is that, you know, the smartest people today are working on figuring out the problem of how to convince you to buy a toaster immediately after you've bought a toaster. And that's my example of what AI really is. It's the fact that I just bought something on Amazon, and when I go to another site, I see recommended ads for that specific thing. And there's a lot of really what we would consider really niche problems that are unbelievably complicated. And a lot of that comes down to, and one of the reasons why Amazon's so impressive as a company is because, you know, simply getting you to delivered what you want really quickly is an unbelievably complicated supply chain problem. And you need to invest a lot of money and have the smartest people building the smartest algorithms to get your warehouse to deliver things really quickly. And so that's where a lot of the effort is going. Whether the technology has potentials to unlock great things, and I would dream of a world where we be able to colonize Mars and the like.
Right.
Those are kind of far away in the future. Now, what's also somewhat interesting is that technologies that can get us there may not seem that way right now. A lot of input technologies to getting us to colonize Mars may seem maybe the most mundane today. And I saw a company, for example, and their vision was to build mining robots that would be, and their dream, what they wanted these robots to be used for is, you know, we can send them to asteroids, collect resources, send them to a target planet, and they could set up the initial infrastructure for human landing, and so that no human needs to work on building the bases. And I was like, that's so fascinating. But obviously nobody's going to give them money to build that, because that has no value today. It only has a theoretical value down the line. But these same robots can be used on Earth to do very complicated mining operations for minerals we have here that are very dangerous for people to do. And so right now, that company will probably just be a conventional mining robotics company. But they have that objective. They have that long-term objective. And I think I really respect technologists that have that, and that, you know, they'll build something really mundane right now. That technology, the stuff that doesn't look as impressive today, might be what's really, really impressive down the line, is kind of what I think. Like Amazon, Jeff Bezos wanted to go to the moon since the time he built a bookstore.
Yeah.
And so what seemed somewhat mundane was actually an input into something that was far, far more ambitious. And the stuff that's quite flashy, if you look at a lot of the most complicated and advanced AIs and what they're used for today, that flashy stuff I don't think will be as big of an input into, you know, the next generation of world-changing advancements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually think that's a really good way to put it, that a lot of people don't really comprehend in the same way, because a lot of, even if you just look at a lot of the stuff that we have today, you know, even 10 years ago, 10 years ago we were going through a 3D revolution phase where everyone wanted 3D in their households. And now that's, you know, a thing of the past. It was like, we were really dumb for thinking that. A lot of the more mundane things, like you mentioned, is now part of our everyday lives. So I think that's a really good way of looking at that. So Ryan, we are running out of time here. I feel like this is definitely a conversation that could just keep going on and on, because there's so many different facets and areas to discuss and to theorize on and unlock. Where can people find you on social media, and where can people find your work at?
I'm on Twitter at Ryan Carana. My organization's website is advancingprosperity.org, but you can find, I've been published in all sorts of online magazines and newspapers. So if you just, I guess, Google my name, you'll find a lot of those resources.
All right. Well, it really was a pleasure to have you on board today on the program, and we'll definitely have to have you back on, because I think this is really fascinating, and I look forward to more of these sorts of conversations into the future.
Yeah, thank you so much for the opportunity. It was a great time.
Well, that's going to do it for us for this week's edition of the Maliberty Podcast. I want to thank Ryan for joining us on the program this week, and I want to thank him for the work that he's doing, because a lot of the conversations that he is having and a lot of the work that he is doing is really important for our future national dialogue, and it's really important for people to understand these issues at its core. And it's really important for people to understand what they're talking about, why technology is important, and I think Ryan's doing a really fantastic job on all of that. So with that being said, if you haven't checked us out yet on Patreon, and if you really support the show, please consider putting your money where your mouth is and consider donating to us on Patreon. You can do that for as little as $5 a month, and you have a lot of exclusive content there that you can unlock as well. And if you haven't done so already, please go out and subscribe to us on iTunes. Check us out on Twitter at Caleb Franz. Check me out on Twitter at Caleb Franz, I should say. Check us out on Twitter at The Liberty. You can check the organization out at TheLiberty.org. Check us out on Facebook at The Maliberty Initiative. And then until next week, we'll see you.